KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio program from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, Romania goes to the polls in the final round of high-stakes presidential elections.
And he wrote on his blog, I will deal with you individually, not as a group. And this sounds like a very clear threat.
Meanwhile, in Albania, Edi Rama sails to victory once again. And in Turkey, the PKK disbands, ending 40 years of armed Kurdish insurgency. That's all coming up here on Inside Europe. Europe is heading into an electoral super Sunday with millions of voters due to cast their ballots in snap legislative elections in Portugal, first round presidential elections in Poland, and second round presidential elections in Romania. In both Poland and Romania, insurgent far-right candidates risk upsetting the balance of power in countries which are crucial allies to neighbouring Ukraine. We'll be hearing more from Poland next week, but for now, it is Romania that is our focus. On Sunday, voters will be effectively choosing between two worlds. On the one hand, there is the world represented by the centrist mayor of Bucharest, Nicoș Dan, running on an independent anti-corruption platform, advocating for continued support for Ukraine and continued alignment with Brussels. On the other hand, there is the world represented by far-right challenger George Simeon, a MAGA-style nationalist and Trump admirer who opposes military aid to Ukraine, is critical of Brussels, and has a background in football hooliganism. At the time of recording, most polls put the two men neck and neck. To help me understand how we got here, I spoke to Dana Scherler. She's head of DW's Romanian department. I asked Dana to begin with a crucial backstory. The cancellation of previous elections late last year, following concerns that another far-right candidate, Calin Georgescu, had benefited from Russian interference.
Exactly. So the cancellation of the elections in the winter of 2024 also fueled a lot of anger, a lot of frustration, a lot of controversy. And those elections were cancelled also because of allegations of international meddling, so of Russian interference, and also because of this illegal financing. So in my opinion, it was right to cancel those elections because of these reasons. But the authorities in Romania didn't do a very good job when it comes to explaining why this happened, why the Constitutional Court of Romania had to cancel these elections. And so, of course, a lot of conspiracy theories were born from there. I mean, we had conspiracy theories before also. But there is this huge gap in society, this huge feeling of division between the supporters of the far-right extremists, the supporters of Calin Georgescu and of George Simeon on the one hand, and on the other hand, the supporters of the pro-European candidate, Nicoș Dan. And it's very hard to reconcile the people who support these very different candidates. So there are huge conflicts also inside circles of friends or colleagues at work or even inside families because of these issues.
Well, I was going to ask, I mean, this must be having a huge impact on you and your colleagues and the work that you're doing and the way in which people are responding to your journalism. How is it sort of impacting the way that you work?
Well, it doesn't actually change the way that we work. I mean, being as objective as possible is always our goal, and explaining the different perspectives, just explaining what happens, has always been our job, and it will always be our job, no matter what others say. But this very deep division in society, of course, is something that we see in the comments we receive on social media, for example, that we also receive a lot of hate and a lot of hate messages, and also a lot of very vulgar messages, for example, from supporters of the far-right candidate, Georgia Simeon, who are criticizing us whenever we post something about the pro-European candidate or about the EU in general.
So we're obviously talking about elections that are taking place in a context of an extremely polarized society, a society in which there is a big distrust of government, of the judiciary, and of the media. Do you see any potential for healing here?
Well, it depends on who will win the elections, because the pro-European candidate, Nico Jordan, has underlined again and again that he wants to be the president of all of Romania, and that he's open to communicate with everyone, and of course open to include those who have different opinions. Whereas, on the other hand, the far-right candidate, Georgia Simeon, even threatened those who are against him. So, for example, he wrote on his blog at the beginning of this week, "What shall I do with you?" referring to those who don't vote for him, to those who criticize him in the media, for example. And he wrote on his blog, "I will deal with you individually, not as a group." And this sounds like a very clear threat.
So very serious domestic implications. What about the wider context, Dana? And I suppose I'm particularly conscious, of course, that Romania is not the only country in Europe that will be heading to the polls on the 18th. Poland as well. When you look across at their presidential elections, do you see any parallels?
Well, yes, because far-right candidates are quite successful in both countries. And at the same time, both countries are of major importance for the EU and for NATO, for NATO's eastern flank, and of major importance for continuing the military aid to Ukraine. And just how important this choice is for Romanians and for Europe and NATO is also shown by an open letter published in several Romanian media outlets that was signed by 7 former U.S. ambassadors to Romania, both Republicans and Democrats. And they warned that Romania was facing a historic choice. So a choice between being an ally of America in NATO or between being dominated by Russia. And Adrian Zuckerman, a Republican, former ambassador to Romania during Donald Trump's first term, even said about Georgia Simeon in this open letter that this extremist candidate is a danger to democracy and a danger to freedom and to prosperity.
Dana, finally, what lessons do you think other countries might be able to learn from the Romanian experience going back to the first round elections late last year?
Well, I think one lesson is that Russia's hybrid warfare is a real threat to Europe, and we must pay more attention to it. We must pay more attention also to propaganda on TikTok, on social media in general, and to fake news. And we should not think that because we are a EU country, everything is quite okay and we shouldn't worry that much. Another lesson, I think, is also that authorities need to explain to the public more thoroughly and more clearly why they are doing what they are doing. Like in this case, it has not been explained clearly enough why the elections were cancelled. And I think this also fueled the anger and frustration of many voters.
So communication is a key. Dana Shele, head of DW's Romanian service, thank you so much for coming on the programme.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
For more election reporting from Dana and her colleagues, keep an eye on DW's Europe pages. Now, Whilst the political situation in Romania was still very much yet to be decided as we went to air, in Albania, everything continues as before. Prime Minister Edi Rama has won an unprecedented fourth successive term in office following a commanding victory for his Socialist Party in this week's parliamentary elections. They comfortably swatted away the challenge of the right-wing Democratic Party, led by the former Prime Minister and President Sali Berisha. A lot of international coverage has depicted Mr. Rama's victory as a significant milestone along Albania's path to EU membership. But concerns persist about corruption and concentration of power, as Guy Delaunay reports.
Election officials were still counting the ballots, but by Wednesday evening, the Socialist Party felt confident in their victory. Their rally in Albania's capital Tirana celebrated the capture of more than half the votes cast in the general election. That'll give them an unassailable majority in parliament and an unprecedented fourth term as prime minister for their leader, Edi Rama. He'd campaigned on a platform of securing European Union membership by the end of the decade, and it's a claim he repeated in his moment of triumph.
We have inspired more people to be proud of a European Albania, which we are building stone by stone. And that's why we have won so many votes. Such support looks like a referendum for an Albania that will be a member of the European Union. Between the starlight of Europe and the darkness of the abyss, Albania has chosen the stars.
But Albania is still a relatively young democracy. It only emerged from decades of communist dictatorship in the 1990s, and the concept of gracefully accepting defeat at the ballot box still hasn't caught on. The right-wing Democratic Party came a distant second in the polls, but its leader, Sali Berisha, claimed that was down to dirty tricks. He's consistently accused Mr. Rama of corruption and connections with organised crime. That's despite Mr. Berisha facing corruption charges himself and being subject to US sanctions.
I ask Prime Minister Rama to stop encouraging his gangs, his criminals, killers, to intimidate and try to reverse the results of the elections.
In Tirana, it's not hard to find people who are utterly fed up of both main parties. That's reflected in the low turnout of just over 40%.
The biggest challenge is the deadlock that the two main parties have created the last 34 years, and the electoral system, which needs to change and needs to give a chance to new parties.
Because the Albanians are moving outside of Albania, the hope and the democracy, because we don't have democracy.
Of course we hope for EU accession, but this government has been in power for far too long, so we need some change, so I hope for a change.
That kind of disenchantment is hard to square with the image that Edi Rama wants to present of Albania as a progressive country at the head of the queue to become the EU's next member state. But emigration figures tell their own story. Tens of thousands of people leave every year for countries which they believe will offer a better future.
People are feeling demotivated, even depressed, I would dare say.
Analyst Gressa Hasser says the decade-plus dominance of the Socialist Party hasn't brought economic benefits for many Albanians.
People in Albania, they need safety, they need prosperity, they need incentives and hope to stay in the country. The living wages are really, really low, especially with the expenses in the country. Living expenses in Albania are higher than in any EU country, especially in comparison to how much people get at the end of the month. Many people are really demotivated, so they try to seek hope and build a better future elsewhere. There is no hope that Rama is gonna guarantee, you know, like something extraordinary. Like, we already know where the Rama is and we already know what he's capable of.
That's a rather bleak analysis, but international events may help Edi Rama fulfill his promises. War in Ukraine and Donald Trump in the White House seem to have reignited the EU's enthusiasm for expansion to the Western Balkans. And this week, European Council President Antonio Costa made an extended visit to the region with his final stop in Tirana. The purpose of my visit is also to build confidence, he said. We are truly committed, from a political point of view, to ensuring this enlargement. Mr. Costa emphasized that candidate countries need to complete an extensive reform process, and in that regard, Albania has made significant progress.
There is definitely some momentum and the window, at least for Montenegro and Albania.
Agor Malici is a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council think tank.
They do not have the kind of obstacles that the other countries do. And Albania is doing something that suggests justice sector reform is one of the only sort of EU-sponsored rule of law reforms in the region that is sort of working. So they have what to show, both Montenegro and Albania, they're NATO members, and they have the least amount of obstacles, and they're moving fast in opening. Albania just opened like another cluster, will be opening another cluster in June now. So it's moving fast, whether other countries are just basically stagnating. So there is something there.
Albania's week started with the eye-catching visit of the Giro d'Italia bike race. It ends much as usual, with Edi Rama in the Prime Minister's office and Sali Berisha promising protests. Albanians want that particular cycle to end, and despite the lack of guarantees, EU accession talks still offer the best hope. Guy Delaunay, DW, Ljubljana.
You know what? I feel a quiz coming on. Next week, we will be bringing you a security special with a Baltics twist. In way of preparation, we want to know the name of the large-scale international military exercise being led by the Estonian Defence Forces this month. Is it Exercise Walrus, Exercise Wolf Cub, Exercise Baltic Bear, or Exercise Hedgehog? Head on over to Spotify, either if you know the answer or if you just want to take a guess. Inside Europe is, of course, also available on all the other usual platforms as well. You are listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week saw an end to over 40 years of bloodshed. The leaders of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, which has been waging a war against Turkey for greater Kurdish rights, announced an end to their armed struggle and the disarmament and dissolution of the rebel group, which is designated by the European Union and most of Turkey's Western allies as a terrorist organisation. More than 40,000 people died in the conflict, but as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, the road to peace is still not assured, with many unanswered questions and public scepticism.
Upon the news that the PKK was ending its war and disarming, Kurds danced in the streets of the predominantly Kurdish southeast of Turkey. The region bore the brunt of the brutal war, which started back in 1984, when the PKK launched its armed struggle for Kurdish rights and autonomy against Turkey's then military rulers, who didn't even acknowledge the existence of Kurds, referring to them as Mountain Turks. But nearly 50 years on, and more than 40,000 dead, Turkey is a different place. The third largest parliamentary party is the pro-Kurdish Dem Party. While increasing Turkish military successes against the PKK made the peace call inevitable, says analyst Aydın Selcen, who once served as a senior Turkish diplomat in the region.
From a technical and military point of view, PKK lost. Since almost 10 years, there are no armed attacks by PKK inside Turkey because they are not able to do that. And two, inside Iraq, on the northern half of the Iraqi Kurdistan region, there are almost no longer any presence of PKK. And the other thing is, also, I think, the developments in Syria, because for the first time in history, the PKK's Syrian outlet, YPG, they started administering a region. So it's important for the organization to keep that administration. So they are rebranding themselves and they become more of a political organization.
In announcing the end of its war, the PKK leadership, based in the mountains of neighboring Iraq, declared that a political space now exists in Turkey for it to carry on its struggle politically. The Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, "This is a golden opportunity," says Asla Aydintaşbaş of the Brookings Institution. If Erdogan can secure the parliamentary support of the pro-Kurdish Dem Party, then he will have the votes he needs in order to change the constitution and end term limits, so that he can stand again for the presidency.
This is a win for Erdogan, no doubt. Yes, Erdogan will, of course, be negotiating with Kurds for constitutional changes. Now we're entering a very transactional period in Turkish politics. Instead of repressing Kurds, it's going to be about negotiating with Kurds. That's not going to go down well for the Turkish public, particularly the nationalists, but I think there will be a government effort to explain that.
The government could be facing an uphill task. According to a recent opinion poll, 3-1 of people polled oppose the peace process with the PKK. For decades, the PKK has been portrayed in Turkey as a vicious terrorist organization whose imprisoned leader, Abdullah Öcalan, is invariably referred to by politicians and much of the media as the baby killer. Sezin Öner, a political commentator of Turkey's Politikyol news portal, says the government has failed to prepare the ground for peace.
In the peace processes around the world, you see a big emphasis to convince the society. So there are reconciliation processes, truth commissions, etc., specifically to convince the public. But in our case, it's like a surgery without anesthesia. So it's you have the operation starting without any kind of sedatives or anything. According to public surveys, Erdogan party's voters are also not convinced by and large. So there's a general distrust and the negativity towards the process in general.
Public pressure on Erdogan is likely to grow, with the PKK and Kurdish political leaders demanding political concessions to facilitate the peace and disarmament process. Professor Mesut Yeğen, an expert on Kurdish affairs of the Istanbul-based think tank, the Reform Institute.
In the next few months, the government is first of all expected to change the conditions of Öcalan. The second thing has to do with those who are in jail and those who are not in a good health condition. They are expected to be released. And for the disarmament process to work in a smooth manner, there should be a kind of either amnesty or a reduction in punishment so that the PKK convicts in the Turkish prisons may be released. And those PKK militants who are expected to return back to Turkey would not be put into jail. And lastly, I think the Kurdish deputies and the mayor, political prisoners basically, are released.
For now, there have been no government announcements on any reforms, other than Erdogan saying good things will follow any disarmament. But the main opposition, CHP party, while welcoming the peace process, is demanding that any measures to free Kurdish prisoners be extended to all political prisoners, including the Istanbul mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu, Erdogan's main political rival. While the peace process is widely seen as a political win for Erdogan, it could yet turn out to be a political liability for the president, who risks being caught between a sceptical voter base and Kurds impatient for concessions. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Before we go to break, there is just time for me to remind you of our feedback address, insideeurope@dw.com. We really do read all of your mails and enjoy receiving them, so do use it if you want to reach out. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We're with The World, Public Radio's leading global news program.
We cover the biggest news events developing every day and give you the context you need to make sense of them.
And Carolyn, I also like our smaller stories, tales of discovery and human kindness, things that make us laugh.
Stories that kind of shrink our world and make us feel more connected.
Subscribe and listen every weekday to The World.
Welcome to Those Who Can't Teach Anymore, a narrative podcast series that explores why teachers are leaving education and what can be done to stop the exodus. This season, we're getting a look at the year and the life of teachers from across the country through their audio journals.
I am Darcy Ostermiller.
This is Megan Overgoff.
This is Sophie V.
This is Charlie Blackwood.
This is Taylor Barron.
This is Iva Moss Ridman.
This is David Whisker.
This is Dan Morris.
This is Amanda Smith.
Look for Those Who Can't Teach Anymore, Season 2, a different kind of the same thing.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio program from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. We're going full European smorgasbord for you in the next half hour with stories on Russian-Ukrainian solidarity in Armenia, Eurovision, and an adult toy craze with connective potential. First, though, remember this. It's been a week since those cheers went up in St. Peter's Square as white smoke billowed from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel, announcing that Habemus Papam, we have a Pope. Amongst the crowd was seasoned Vatican reporter Megan Williams. What was that moment like, I asked her?
This is the third time I've been in St. Peter's Square when that white smoke came up. I was there for Benedict and I was there for Francis. But I have to say, there was something even more exciting. I think partly because it was daytime. It was earlier than people had expected because, as it turned out, it was the fourth round of voting, not the fifth. So it was just after 6 o'clock Rome time. And bright sunshine, you know, just a beautiful time of day. And then you could just clearly see this billowing smoke. And the crowd, of course, erupted. You know, I really felt goosebumps. I mean, it was so exciting. And of course, people really didn't have a sense of who it might be.
Right. Okay, because that's the thing, right? There's this sort of weird time slip between the moment when we know that we've got a new pope, but until the moment that the pope appears on the balcony, we don't know who he is, right? Take me back to that moment. What were the reactions on the square as people realized who had been chosen?
Well, it was a moment of confusion because most people didn't know who he was. You know, I knew who he was because, you know, this is part of my job. I follow the Vatican and all of us who follow it had our short list of the papabili, the papal contenders. And he was on it, but not near the top. I don't think he was near the top of anybody's list. But, you know, people who don't follow the Vatican closely, they just had never heard of him. And then to be a pope from the United States, that was even more astounding because common wisdom amongst Vaticanists and, you know, bishops and people close to the power center of the Holy See, they always say there'll never be a pope from the United States. It just won't happen for geopolitical reasons. And, you know, mind you, they said that about Jesuit popes as well. And of course, Francis got elected. You could just see everybody kind of trying to wrap their minds around this incredibly surprising outcome.
And in the US, of course, there was a lot of mind wrapping to be done because Cardinal Robert Prevost is not necessarily a figure with whom the Trump administration is likely to feel particularly comfortable.
No, they couldn't be further apart politically, morally, many people would say. Prevost, now Pope Leo XIV, is very much cut from the same cloth as Pope Francis. His kind of Catholicism is social justice Catholicism. So concern about the marginalized, the poor, the weak, the forgotten. And just merely by the choice of his name, which he clarified shortly after, but it was clear even before he explained why he chose that name, that it was a choice after Pope Leo XIII, who was a pope during the Industrial Revolution at the end of the 19th century, who introduced Catholic social teaching with an important document outlining the importance of the church's role in responding to the excesses of capitalism and the exploitation of workers. And Pope Leo XIV, those are clearly his priorities. As we know, you know, he's a North American pope, in having been born and raised in Chicago, but he's also a South American pope. He spent a few decades in Peru. There, he's very much considered one of them. He's not considered a gringo. You talk to anybody who knows him from Peru, and they speak very highly of him, particularly with regards to his understanding of colonialism, colonial crimes, walking with indigenous people and their concerns. And, you know, from having spoken with a few people in the know, it was the South American cardinals who really gave him the boost, the initial boost in the conclave voting.
Hmm. You were at his first press conference as Pope, I believe, Megan. What can you tell me about that? What kind of clues did you get about the Pope that he intends to be moving forwards?
That was an interesting speech he gave because, again, I was at Benedict's and Pope Francis's as well. They were mostly concerned. I mean, you know, they talked about communicating truth and beauty and goodness in the world, but they were mostly concerned about advising those of us present on how we should be reporting on the Vatican and the Catholic Church. Whereas Pope Leo, you know, he spoke out against imprisoning journalists and called for the release of journalists who are imprisoned. And he thanked war correspondents who risked their lives on the front line. And he talked about artificial intelligence and the need to use that responsibly. And he spoke about, you know, loud ideological voices, you know, his concern about those voices drowning out other voices, and encouraged journalists to champion the voices of the weak, people, he said, who don't have a voice. So much more outward looking about, you know, the real risks to freedom of expression.
Hmm. Megan, thank you for that fascinating insight into, yeah, Pope Leo and the goings-on in Rome.
Thanks, Kate. My pleasure.
Megan Williams there. And Megan's work, by the way, is not yet over, because there is the small matter of Pope Leo's inauguration ceremony to report on before she or any of the other journalists in St. Peter's Square can pack up their kit and go home. That is happening this Sunday at 10 a.m. Roman time. Will it bring Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky together with US Vice President J.D. Vance? Or would that be a miracle too far? We shall see. In the meantime, as we went to studio on Thursday, talks between Ukrainian and Russian officials were due to get underway in Turkey. Our colleagues over at DW News will be following that story closely. Here on Inside Europe, however, we have a story of rather more modest, although perhaps altogether more concrete, hope taking place right now in neighbouring Armenia. Each year since Russia's full-scale invasion, hundreds of Ukrainian refugees have arrived seeking shelter in the country. Russians, too, have been turning up, most of them prompted by anti-war sentiment and the fear of enlistment into an army whose actions they oppose. Once safely in the capital Yerevan, some of them have chosen an altogether different type of enlistment instead, volunteering with a small non-profit aimed at helping their Ukrainian counterparts navigate the challenges of life in a new country. From Yerevan, Shant Sherigan sent us this report.
It's a mild spring Saturday in Yerevan, and couples, elderly people, and some individuals with children are filing in and out of an office building paces away from the city center. They're here to pick up small bags of foodstuffs and take their pick of donated clothing, a roughly monthly ritual organized by a nonprofit called Dopo Moga. The refugees enter a small front office with a big Ukrainian flag and other symbols of the country decorating the space. As one volunteer looks up the visitor's info in an organizer, another dashes down a narrow corridor packed with shelves full of clothing. He heads to a back storage room and readies a bag of food for a refugee in need. In a country where roughly a quarter of the population lives below the poverty line, it's been hard for new arrivals to find work.
We have two different types of pasta. Now it's time for canned meat, canned fish.
Dopomoga, which means help in Ukrainian, sprang up right after the 2022 invasion. Founder Olena Shevchuk, who's from Odessa, started by providing informal advice to Ukrainians newly arrived in Armenia, where she'd come years earlier with her husband. She quickly grew the organization to offer emergency food aid and clothing, along with cultural events too.
When the crisis began and refugees started to come here, we had no hesitations on what we should do. We started to give our help. However, the amount of refugees was quite high.
Funding has come from sources including private donations and small grants from UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Office. Dobomoga's volunteers are a mix of Armenians, Ukrainians like Shevchuk, and Russians who feel a sense of responsibility in the aftermath of the invasion. One of those volunteers, Anton Ronis, moved from St. Petersburg to Yerevan after the war started, when his anti-war activism drew his university's ire and his own mother was arrested on the sidelines of a demonstration. Ronis, who's 23, decided to get out.
I dropped my university and I understood that that's time to leave the country because I can do nothing here. Well, I could do, but it would be a capital punishment for me.
A Ukrainian woman named Ina stops by to pick up some essentials. She said she fled from Kharkiv with her two children after the invasion began. Armenia was a logical choice since the father of her younger child is Armenian, she said.
Взагалі, ми почали жити з нуля, скажімо так.
We came here and had to restart our life. We came here with nothing and had to start over from the very beginning.
Asked about the fact Russian emigres are among the volunteers providing help, Ina said she doesn't care where they came from.
This community is a real family. There's one goal here, to help refugees. And that's why we don't actually care where people come from. They always think about helping Ukrainians, helping Ukraine.
In Europe and beyond, Russian expats have volunteered to help Ukrainian refugees, weathering criticism back home that they're betraying the Russian cause. But perhaps no situation is quite like the one in Armenia. The former Soviet country has long lived in Russia's shadow and has tense ties with the Kremlin today. Authorities here have allowed small anti-war demonstrations since the invasion began. Russians don't need a visa to travel here, so Armenia has been one of the main destinations for Russian migrants during the war, according to the UN. About 40,000 Russians moved to Armenia during just the first 6 months of the conflict, according to the Armenian government. In the meantime, hundreds of Ukrainian refugees per year have sought asylum in Armenia. Most have Armenian heritage or an Armenian spouse, officials say. Others came from Russian-occupied Ukraine, have Russian passports, and can't enter the European Union. Zavin Margaryan is an Armenian native who lived in Mariupol his entire adult life. The 42-year-old and his family stuck it out until his brother was slain, and he himself lost a leg in an attack last year. Margaryan says at first, he was surprised to see Russians and Ukrainians working side by side, helping people like his family of eight.
I quickly realized that just because there are some rotten people in a nation, that doesn't make all of the people bad. What I saw was people were far from the war and helping each other, and Russians and Ukrainians could sit at the same table, interact, and still empathize and assist each other.
Not long after the invasion of Ukraine, a new flood of refugees came to Armenia. Azerbaijan drove over 115,000 inhabitants of nearby Nagorno-Karabakh out of the long-disputed territory in fall 2023. Gevorg Ter-Gabrielyan, an Armenian author and critic, says Armenians tend to view both the Kremlin and Kiev through the lens of the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict. But he says the Russians' arrival has upended stereotypes here. They've organized civic events like environmental cleanups, along with contributing to Dobomoga's work.
The fact is that this community that came from Russia, the young people, they have been very advanced in taking a civic action.
Ter-Gabrielyan says the same thing goes for Ukrainian refugees.
If you take this stereotypical approach, then Ukraine supported Azerbaijan, just like Russia did. So there should be a negative attitude towards Ukrainians, but it has never been the case in Armenia. So all these stereotypes went away.
So to enter the building without a key, you need to do it like this.
Along with food assistance, Dobomoga runs a shelter for refugees near downtown Yerevan. Several men and women are currently living at the shelter. It's quiet the day we visit. A few people who work night shifts are sleeping, and a Dobomoga volunteer watches a football match in a nearby room. It reminds Ronis, who's showing me around, of home.
I recall every moment of my previous life in Russia. I understand that those guys with which I was sitting, for example, during football games, drinking beer on the streets of St. Petersburg, maybe they joined the army and they are killing Ukrainians now. I have to do more here, like to help refugees, to help Ukraine in any ways that it needs.
Back at Dopomoga's office, a special treat of vareniki, Ukrainian dumplings, are being made. Volunteers peel and mash potatoes, dice herbs, and saute onions that will go into the savory dish. Eventually, the ingredients are ready, and a group of refugees has started to cook dozens of dumplings. Some of the participants break out in song and dance as Ukrainian tunes play in the background. About a dozen refugees and volunteers get ready for an evening feast. By the end of the day, 40 families, or 101 people, have received food aid from the nonprofit. Hundreds of miles away, war continues in Ukraine, with no clear end in sight. I'm Shant Sharagyan, 4DW in Yerevan.
In times of war, small gestures take on outsized significance, and friendship can become just about the most radical gift that we have to offer. So, what if we could all stand side by side, united by something greater than ourselves? By music, for instance. That, no less, is the aspiration expressed by the United by Music slogan, adopted by the European Song Contest, also known as Eurovision. Last year in Malmö, the competition's aim of bringing people together was challenged by large protests against Israel's participation and an outcry from Dutch fans when the Netherlands was disqualified hours before the grand finale. So, is this year any different? The venue this time is Basel, and the organisers seem to have been hoping for something of a reset in traditionally neutral Switzerland. With the finals taking place this weekend, we tasked reporter and Eurovision mega fan Daniel Rosny with finding out whether or not it's worked.
If you've never been to a Eurovision host city before, then it's probably best to picture the Olympic Village of the music world. Bars, restaurants and cafes all get in on the action to attract the thousands of fans dressed in their glittery finery.
So I'm Dominic, I'm Portuguese, but you just feel like the diversity really coming together, different nationalities and all the flags and everything, and that's really cool, yeah.
And what's your name?
Florence. We are from Brittany. Now that I have been to all this events, I can imagine myself just behind my TV. It's not the same.
I'm Sarah. I come from Tampere, Finland. It's still maybe a one-time like experience.
The Eurovision Song Contest is now the biggest entertainment show in the world, with more than 160 million watching each year. And the artists want to take the contest slogan to heart.
Hi, my name is Luan. I'm competing in the ESC for France, and my song is called Maman. I really couldn't imagine that like we were all going to get along so well. Like, we're basically doing, like, pyjama parties in my room.
And a lot of work goes into one three-minute performance. Could you give us a bit of an insight into the weeks, the months of rehearsals that go into it?
So we've been working on it since February. So many studio rehearsals. And it was a really deep process because we really wanted to, like, show the intimacy of the song. It's an homage for me. My parents were not French. My mother arrived in France when she was a teen. It's a way for me to thank my country for welcoming my family and me being able to grow up in such an incredible country.
One of the unique elements of Eurovision is that it brings the continent together, from Ireland to Iceland, Slovenia to Spain, and Croatia to Cyprus. In more ways than one, this year's competition feels like the centre of Europe, as the Swiss city of Basel sits on both the French and German borders, meaning visitors get a taste of three different cultures. For months, the 37 artists have been getting to know each other, but now they're setting their sights on victory.
hardly anyone knew us before, and now a lot of people know us. So I'm very excited to bring our music to so many more people who can then enjoy it and listen to it.
Abo and Tuna are representing Germany and are expected to do well on Saturday's grand final with their modern electro-pop song.
On one hand, of course, it's a little bit of pressure. The expectations we have for our own performance, we want to fulfill them. And everything then that comes after that and over that is just nice to have, you know. If Germany likes our act, it's nice to have. If the other nations give us points, it's nice. But I think in the end, it really counts that we're here on the biggest music event of all time.
Organisers are hoping that following the political tensions which erupted at last year's event in Malmö, Eurovision 2025 will be something of a reset, a politics-free celebration of Eurofem in traditionally neutral Switzerland. Konradin Kramer is the head of Basel's government and knows the city will have a huge economic boost through the visitors this week.
We're expecting more than 100,000. It will be something between 100 and 500,000. We are well prepared. We are not naive. We know what's going on in the world. And I am convinced that in this situation the world is in and Europe is in, it, the more important it is to celebrate events like Eurovision Song Contest, where people from all nations come together for a friendly championship.
However, with UN experts and human rights groups like Amnesty International warning that Israel's warfare in Gaza is consistent with the characteristics of genocide, including the use of starvation as a weapon of war, its continued participation in the contest remains controversial. In the run-up to the event, over 70 former participants signed an open letter demanding the exclusion of Khan, the Israeli public broadcaster, citing Russia's removal in 2022 as precedent. Ireland's broadcaster, RTE, also requested that the European Broadcasting Union review Khan's participation, saying that it was mindful of the severe political pressure on Israel's public service broadcaster from the Israeli government. RTE says that it has received a commitment from the EBU to have a wider discussion amongst members in due course. In the meantime, the EBU's position is that the Israeli case is different to that of Russia in 2022, since no broadcaster is yet to publicly ask for Israel to be banned.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Oh my God, I'm so excited. Look at you all. So beautiful. Thank you.
During the opening ceremony on Sunday, an estimated 100,000 fans turned up to celebrate the contest. When the Israeli act, a singer called Yuval Raphael, who is a survivor of Hamas's October the 7th attack on the Nova Music Festival, appeared, she was booed. But on the whole, protests have been much smaller than in Malmö last year. The Palestinian flag was visible in the crowds, and unlike last year, it is allowed in the arena during the shows. Previously, only the flags of the nations competing and the rainbow flag, because of Eurovision's connection with the LGBT community, were permitted. This year, any flag can be brought into the arena by the audience. But for the artists, it's strictly their country's flag, and they're banned from the pride flag on stage or in the televised green room, something last year's winner Nemo, Switzerland's first openly non-binary entrant, has publicly criticised. On the streets of Basel, though, it's the flags from all 37 participating nations flying in the wind. This, as the organisers are keen to stress, is supposed to be a celebration of unity and diversity. And so far, it seems to be working. Daniel Rosny, DW, Basel, Switzerland.
And if Eurovision wasn't exciting enough for you, we've got a feature on adult toys coming up next. That's still to come here on Inside Europe. I promised you a feature on adult toys, and I shall deliver. Before you get any wrong ideas, however, I should tell you that the toys in question are Legos. The Danish firm posted record profits this March, a notable outlier in a year that was hard on the toy industry as a whole. The reason? Adults. Lego is luring adult builders who are willing to shell out upwards of $500 for a set. Now, other toy companies are following suit, with Mattel and Hasbro also focusing on the so-called kidult market. This report by Sarah Birnbaum was first aired on The World, a co-production of PRX and GBH Boston.
Chris Mack played with Legos as a kid. He never thought he'd get back into it. But then came the long days of lockdown with his preteen daughter.
We had a couple of my old Lego sets, and I took one of them out for her to build. And she built that, and then built another, and then built another. And then we had this idea, well, maybe we'll connect them all with a train track. And then we had this idea that the train would go through different lands. And then we ran out of space, we needed a second land. And we ran out of space, we needed a third land. And then...
There's still more lands to come.
Yeah.
Can you Chris and Maddie's Lego creations take up half the living room, the hallways, the space under the stairs.
And those two additional tables got added.
Grown-up builders like Chris are helping Lego cement its status as the world's biggest toy maker. When Lego started in the 1950s, it didn't have adults in mind. It was just focused on children.
Hey, kids, look! A whole new world to build.
Yes, there were adult hobbyists and collectors. They call themselves AFOLs, A-F-O-Ls, adult fans of Lego. But they were a small percentage of Lego's customer base. Eventually, Lego realized, hey, there's a big business opportunity here that we aren't taking advantage of. And in 2019, they started marketing their sets to a new type of customer, the stressed-out adult who's just looking for a little me time or a moment of zen.
We all know it's not always so easy. Find your flow. Build with Lego bricks. Adults welcome.
In 2020, Lego launched its adults category. These are sets designed and packaged specifically for adults.
These boxes are black. The writing is very elegant. Kind of feels like this is an adult product, and it has an adult price tag to match. We're looking at like $650 for the Ultimate Collector Series Star Wars Attack Cruiser.
Lego won't say how much of their sales are adults buying for themselves, but you can get some idea by looking at the products they offer. Out of the 745 sets listed on the American website, 20% are labeled 18+. According to the consumer research group Circana, in 2024, for the very first time, grown-ups surpassed preschoolers as the biggest consumers of toys. Frédéric Tutte, Circana's toy expert, says kids today just aren't connecting to physical toys like dolls and action figures the way previous generations did.
They tend to switch to other categories earlier than they used to. So they play on their phones, they play video games. Obviously, this is a challenge for the toy industry.
Pair that with declining fertility rates. There are fewer children in Europe and the US than there were 10 years ago. And you can see why the toy industry is going after grown-ups. That's All Right by Chris Mack. He and Maddie have big plans.
Do you want to talk about Hogwarts?
Yeah. Okay. We're working on...
Our thanks to reporter Sarah Birnbaum and also to The World program for permission to share that story with you. Find The World wherever you get your podcasts. Also, at this point, I really want to make a shout out to my definitely adult cousin Luke, who I happen to know for a fact has completed the Hogwarts set and many others besides. I guess some hobbies are just more constructive than others. That is it for today. This programme was produced by Sam Baker and me, Kate Laycock, with help from sound engineer Michael Springer. Extra editorial support was from Sanya Blagojevich. Our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. We really do love receiving your comments and ideas for the programme, so please do use that address if you want to reach out. Many of the usual podcast platforms also have comment functions as well, and we, of course, massively appreciate ratings and reviews. since they help other listeners to find us. I'll be back next week. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.
smashing.